Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries podcast. We have a very special guest with us here today, Walter Borneman. And if you remember, we interviewed Walter specifically about Admiral Nimitz, and he gave us a wonderful account of his writing and research on Admiral Nimitz from his book that he did called The Admirals, which was an excellent book, great reading. And at the same time, he forwarded the book Brothers Down to me, which was his story of Pearl Harbor and the fate of many brothers aboard the USS Arizona. The research is so good and so thorough that he literally puts you on the Arizona in Pearl Harbor on December 7th in 1941. It was incredible. There were 38 sets of brothers that served aboard that ship. There were 2,403 Americans killed at Pearl Harbor. The Arizona accounted for 1,177 of those. And the casualty rate among the brothers was an incredible 80%. It was December 1941. Buddy Christensen and Big Brother Sonny were about to head into Honolulu to take a photo together to send to their mother for Christmas. "Wait here," Sonny told Buddy before disappearing below decks to fetch a hat. Buddy never saw him again. The surprise attack at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, remains one of the most traumatic events in American history. America's battleship fleet was crippled. Thousands of lives were lost, and the United States was propelled into a world war. Few realize, however, that aboard the iconic, doomed USS Arizona were an incredible 78 blood relatives. Tragically, in an era when family members serving together was an accepted, even encouraged practice, 63 of the Arizona's 1,177 dead turned out to be brothers. In Brothers Down, acclaimed historian Walter R. Borneman returns to that critical week of December, masterfully guiding us on an unforgettable journey of sacrifice and heroism, all told through the lives of these brothers and their fateful experience on the Arizona. To tell the moving stories of the men and their parents, wives, and sweethearts, Borneman draws from a treasure trove of unpublished source material and sheds new light on the day that changed these families' lives and the world forever. Walt, it's good to have you with us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. It's good to be with you again. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. Are you staying busy? You've got at least, 25 books in print?
Well, not quite that many, but I might be pushing 20, so there you go.
Well, you've been prolific. And this book, Brothers Down, is just, it's a book that just grabs you in the gut and just keeps going. It's a fantastically well-researched book and well-written. It makes you feel like you're there with these guys.
Well, thanks. You know, I got to say, It's difficult to describe this book because it's certainly much more of an emotional book than I've written in the past. You know, you mentioned my book on the admirals, and I've done a book on James K. Polk, president, a couple of books on earlier wars. But this is the first time I've really focused on the men behind the scenes, if you will, guys who quite frankly, out there in Hawaii in 1941, were kind of hoping just to see the next sunrise. They weren't involved in the politics or the policies much. A lot of them, as I'm sure we'll talk about, are writing home to girlfriends and everything. So I was surprised, John, how much this really affected me personally and emotionally by the time I got done with it.
I think it was in the foreword that you wrote that you were inspired to do this book when you were preparing the admirals and you toured Pearl Harbor. Can you explain that experience?
Sure. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have been to Pearl Harbor, and you know, you go out to the Arizona and take the launch out, and the memorial is very moving. But you go up to the cemetery that's in the Punch Bowl and start going through the names. It's a much more quieter place than the harbor. And I started seeing these names that were from the Arizona and the same surname. And you start to think, my goodness, had there really been that many brothers on this ship? And, you know, I was certainly, when I was writing The Admirals, as you suggest, aware of the big picture. And I was aware of the famous story of the band and that there were brothers on the ship. But I really just had no idea that there were 38 sets, and as you suggest, there were three sets of trios, as well as a father and son on board. And, you know, I think the thing that was most moving to me when I really got into this is that so many of these men are gone. In fact, all of the brothers are gone, but their next generation, and many of them didn't have children. They didn't live long enough to have children. So they're basically in a situation where I'm talking to their nieces or nephews, or sometimes the children of a younger brother who immediately thought that he had to sign up in terms of avenging their deaths. And, it was quite emotional. And I was struck with two things. One, how they were really quite willing, quite proud, actually, to share their relative story with me, number one. And number two, that even if, as it's been by this December, it'll be 80 years since Pearl Harbor, even in that passage of time, people that they and relatives that they didn't necessarily know, how personal the loss that family still feels. So yeah, John, it was an emotional book for me to do.
What was it like working with those families? I know it had to have been gut-wrenching. I know you said they were extremely cooperative and very proud to be able to give you this information so that more Americans know exactly what happened. What was it like for you?
Well, in many cases, I would be interviewing them, sometimes in person. Quite frankly, they were all spread out all over the country by phone or by email exchange. But, I think the neatest part of it, actually, because there was a very rewarding part beyond the kind of the emotions, is that a number of these people in the families who had heard the stories or they were the children of a younger brother, and they're like, oh yeah, we haven't connected with Uncle So-and-so's kids or other relatives in years and years. So it was great in a couple of instances of my research being able to put families together with other parts of their families that they hadn't been in touch with for a while. And actually, sometimes you think about, well, it's best to go and sit down in front of somebody for an interview. But even before all of the Zooms we've been doing of late with the pandemic, a few times I actually arrange conference calls. So we have various siblings on the phone together. And it was great to hear them go back and forth, talk about their experiences growing up, hearing about the relatives that they had. And, it was also great to hear them say, oh, I didn't know that. Or, Uncle Bob told me this or that. So that was kind of a fun part. And I think an uplifting part of the research from the family sides.
You started out the first chapter with the story of the Giovinazzo family. What made you choose them? And why did you choose that to begin your story?
Well, there were many stories I guess I could have chosen, but I wanted to sort of set the scene and set it very personally in one particular family. And the Giovinazzo story is that there were actually two brothers. One, the older one, Joe, was on the repair ship, the Vestal, which ends up being moored next to the Arizona. And a younger brother, Mike, who has been a great baseball player, he'd love nothing better to come back and play a little semi-pro ball. But he's on the Arizona, and he's just about ready to go home on leave. Well, I think the reason that I picked that story is that this family, like every other family, after they heard about the attack, knew they had relatives at Pearl Harbor. And the question is, are they all right? What's going on? And there are people who are writing letters, sending telegrams. They're waiting to hear. And in the Giovinazzo instance, Mike, again, was about ready to come home on leave. And they heard that Joe was safe. They heard that Mike was safe. And then, he didn't show up. And with all the transit and everything, they weren't too worried about that. And then they got a telegram saying he was missing. And of course, having been told that he was okay, which, by the way, the telegram saying he was okay, which was an error, arrived as they were celebrating Christmas Eve. So that's pretty poignant. Well, a few weeks go by, they expect him home on leave, he doesn't show up. And of course, finally, they get the telegram that, gosh, we made a mistake. The Giovinazzo brother, who's alive, is in fact Joe. We regret to inform you that Mike is missing and presumed dead. So, you know, all of these families go through emotional roller coasters, but to be told a couple of different times, a couple of different ways, you know, I felt that was a particularly poignant piece to sort of set the tone. And then, of course, after that, I back up a little bit, tell the history of the ship, because the ship is really a personality in this story as well.
For the sake of our listeners, could you give us a little history of the ship and then also put us on the morning of December 7th, 1941?
Sure. You know, the USS Arizona is launched in 1915. It's 600 feet long. And when it's launched, it really is part of this premier culture of the American Navy, something that they've had really since the 1890s, that the battleship is king or queen, if you will, of the seas. And that's the way you exhibit foreign policy power. That's the way you defend interests, not only at home or around the world. Well, the United States goes and builds battleships very, very quickly. There's a little bit of a moratorium after World War I when a number of people think that, well, you know, maybe there really is going to be peace. But the folks who have signed the Washington Naval Treaty, including Japan, don't really stick by those limitations. So Japan continues to build major battleships, and very quickly the United States decides that it needs to go ahead and continue to build battleships as well. So by the morning of December 7th, 1941, there are actually 9 battleships assigned to the Pacific Fleet. They're all named under the naming convention that the U.S. Navy has used after states. Now, out of those 9, one of them, by coincidence, my home state of Colorado, the USS Colorado is in Bremerton, Washington, undergoing its annual refitting. So there are 8 battleships in Pearl Harbor that morning. They're all anchored and moored along a place called Battleship Row. And what has happened is that as tension has begun to increase with the Japanese over interests in the Pacific. Got to remember, we think of World War II as Americans as starting on December 7th, 1941. But actually, Japan has been at war in Asia since 1937 with China. And in the summer of 1941, Great Britain, the Netherlands, and the United States basically impose an oil embargo on Japan. And they do so to try to shut down Japan's war-making capability. But I think, in retrospect, most historians would agree that maybe that simply expedited Japan's need to strike into the Dutch East Indies, acquire those oil refineries, because there's no oil at home in Japan's home islands. So the fleet is put out at Pearl Harbor, the battleships, as well as aircraft carriers, to try to do 2 things, I think. One, show Japan that the United States is serious about defending its interests. And 2, sort of marshal as forward forces that if Japan strikes south, for example, invades the Philippines, that was sort of what had been wargamed at that time, the U.S. fleet would be able to sail westward and repulse that threat. So that sort of brings us to the morning of December 7th, 1941. So go ahead, John, if you want to ask anything else, or we can continue through that morning, whatever you wish.
We'll return to our interview with Walter Borneman and his book, Brothers Down, the story of the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor, right after these sponsor messages.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
And now we return to our interview. As I understand it, it was the Nevada that was playing the Star Spangled Banner. The band was out on the deck and they were playing the Star Spangled Banner when the first Japanese planes came in.
That's correct. I mean, I think most of us have probably seen the movie Tora, Tora, Tora. And the band, a number of people, and it's like so many of these things, they're sort of legends that grow up, and some of it's shorthand, some of it's just misinformation, would have the band playing on the Arizona. That's not true. All of the bands on capital ships, aircraft carriers and battleships, would routinely congregate in the morning, 8 o'clock, start of a new watch, and play the national anthem as the colors were raised. Well, the Arizona's band was assembled on deck and ready to do that. Somehow, some way, nobody quite figures out why the Nevada's band jumped the gun and began to play the national anthem before the 8 o'clock time. Now, as the band on the Nevada is playing, there's this roar beginning to be heard, and explosions beginning to be heard. And a couple of minutes before 8 o'clock, the first wave of what will really be a three-wave attack by the Japanese, these led by Val dive bombers, come over. And they're accompanied by Japanese Zeros. And their goal is basically to really stymie any kind of counterattack from Hickam Field and the other airstrip on Fort Island. So they're not going out after the battleships immediately, but they are attacking those ancillary facilities. So as all of this roar, and at that point, Japanese Zeros, the fighters, are also beginning to strafe the line of battleships, the band on the Nevada very quickly finishes up and tries to get below decks. And of course, likewise, on the Arizona and the other battleships, as it becomes clear, as I quote one of the brothers in the book, basically, you know, his buddy says to him, "Andy, who are those guys?" Well, many of the sailors recognize the red meatball emblem on the Japanese planes. And it was really, really clear, maybe not necessarily to some of the young green hands, but it was really clear to others, including John Anderson, who had seen a tour in China as an observer, that this was a major attack. So the second wave then, and this is kind of interesting to differentiate between the second and the third wave of planes, there are Kate bombers on both of these waves, but the first wave has been outfitted by torpedoes. And for many years, there was the impression that the Arizona had been struck by torpedoes. Well, that's not really true. The planes come in across there of the Pearl Harbor lock and release torpedoes against particularly the Nevada, whose band has just stopped playing, the West Virginia and the Oklahoma. Now, the West Virginia and the Oklahoma are moored outside, if you will, from Ford Island, with two additional battleships that end up being protected from the torpedoes by the two ships that are outside of them. West Virginia takes torpedoes, starts to sink, starts to roll over. Deputy executive officer begins some counter flooding measures. West Virginia ends up sinking almost even into the mud. The Oklahoma is not so lucky, and it basically takes torpedoes, rolls over. Hundreds of sailors are trapped. So you've got that first wave of great torpedo damage. And then, you know, the Arizona, up till this point, has pretty well escaped any kind of injury. I've got stories from the brothers, those who were assigned to the fore of the ship, the forward part of the ship, none survived. The survivors really come from the rear, and that's because what happens in this third wave is that high altitude bombers fly right up Battleship Row and start to drop bombs. The ships in front of the Arizona take a couple of hits. The Arizona takes some hits, and one bomb, armor-piercing bomb, and actually what these were Japanese naval torpedoes kind of outfitted with fins and stuff to be dropped from high altitude as bombs, goes right through the armor deck plating on the Arizona, and within 60 seconds or so, a secondary fire ignites the whole forward powder magazine, and the Arizona simply blows sky high. I mean, one observer from a ship, I think from the West Virginia close by, says, you know, the entire ship just rose up in the air and shook like a dog. That's his description. And then, of course, with that huge upheaval, as the ship settled back down, those decks forward, I mentioned Gussie Free, who's the father with his son there. Gussie's in sick bay, not feeling well. He's in the forward part of the ship by the forecastle. And, you know, those decks up front just go boom, 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 and start to pancake down. Some of the other brothers, the Christensens, who you allude to, one of the brothers is in the rear of the ship, aft, and he's basically assigned to turret number 4. He gets into the turret. He's safe. He has no idea where his brother is, who went, as you read, to get his clean cap for their photo. And they're trapped in the turret. And only after a while, as the power goes off and everything, do they manage to get out. You know, and we can talk about some more of those experiences, but just while I'm thinking of it, you know, these experiences from these men, you know, some people, a couple of folks, one reviewer said, well, you know, why didn't I include more stories from the men who were on the ship? Well, I think you pointed it out, John, when you got 63 casualties out of 78 brothers, there are not many left to write those personal stories. So I had a piece together what happened to these brothers by, in some cases, the survivor stories, because there were at least 15 brothers who survived, although not all of them were on the ship. A few survivors were in Pearl Harbor. Stories of other people who remembered seeing these men or had their own experiences in terms of getting off the ship. And finally, of course, some measure of first-person accounts from observers. What it was like to see the ship go up, what it was like after that with this two things, this huge column of smoke that just simply engulfs the ship. And then immediately there is this fleet of smaller craft that begin to go through, after the attack at least, begin to go through the waters and rescue what few survivors they can. You know, more often than not, they have the grim experience of retrieving bodies.
Sad, sad story. Well told on your end. What is especially good about not only about all your books that require maps, and especially this book, is your map work is absolutely terrific. I can't recall another book that lays out Pearl Harbor as well as you have here, and gives you a worldview too. Fantastic
work. A big shout out to my cartographer. Thank you, David Lambert.
A lot of people ask, I know it's been asked a million times, and I'm going to ask it again of you. Why were we caught flat-footed
on that day? I think there are a couple of reasons for that. I do not subscribe to sort of the conspiracy theory that somehow we knew or Franklin Roosevelt knew. I think that that's been pretty well discounted, at least down to the level of, oh, we knew when they were coming exactly when. I think there was a widespread perception, certainly from Franklin Roosevelt all the way down, that the Japanese were going to strike somewhere soon. We know that in Washington that Sunday, the Japanese ambassador is an hour late, meeting with Cordell Hull, the Secretary of State, to deliver what was basically an ultimatum. They had anticipated that that would be delivered before the attack. Didn't happen that way. Ended up being a surprise attack, which, quite frankly, galvanized the American nation, as I think few things could do. So the point is that I think everyone from Franklin Roosevelt on down knew that an attack was coming somewhere in the Pacific. They really thought it was going to come, and of course it did come, in the Philippines, but that it was not going to come anywhere close to Hawaii, maybe Midway. In fact, the good thing that there were not aircraft carriers caught in Pearl Harbor is that of the three carriers in the Pacific, Saratoga is on the east coast, or excuse me, on the west coast in east of Pearl Harbor, taking on planes after a outfit in San Diego. The other two carriers are en route to deliver planes to Wake and Midway as reinforcements. So the U.S. is pushing out this line, if you will, of defense. But almost no one expected the attack to come at Pearl Harbor. Now, that said, you know, sometimes there's a little bit of flat-footedness. Sometimes there is just an inability to really experience what might happen. You know, Admiral King, one of the four admirals you and I talked about on with that book, The Admirals, had actually led a war game in 1938 that had planes, obviously U.S. planes, staging a mock attack from the north on the Hawaiian Islands. And, you know, the aftermath of that attack was the Army, who was indeed caught flat-footed on that mock raid, saying, well, what do you mean? You launched that attack on an early Sunday morning. That wasn't fair. So, you know, there was plenty of things to read in the tea leaves of how the U.S. should have been better prepared. Should Admiral Kimmel have had more Pickett destroyers out, perhaps? Yes. Should the Army side of things have flown more sorties, paid more attention to the famous radar blip that everyone discounted? All of those things sort of dominoed. And then, of course,
the captured Japanese
exactly on the morning in Pearl Harbor, you know, trying to slip into the anti-sub nets. All of them
at 6:15 in the morning,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yes,
three hours before the attack.
Yes, very
4 hours
and,
before the
and
attack.
And actually, you know, again, if Kimmel at that point had said, you know, go to general quarters, and not many of these battleships had steam up, the Nevada did, but you know, they either could have sortied or they perhaps could have moved down the channel. Interestingly enough, they were all moored with their bows pointed to sea on purpose so that they could move out as quickly as possible. So all of those things kind of start to stack the deck. And
there were some intelligence guys who got it right, were there not?
Yeah, there are some people who are basically saying, you know, we think actually this is going to happen, and it's going to happen closer. And it might be Pearl Harbor, but there are other people there who are just saying, oh, that's absolutely an impossibility. And you know, I guess in terms of strategic impossibilities, at that point, it really shows the difference between the Japanese having gone ahead and embraced carriers and carrier operations, and the United States really still relying on battleships. Bill Halsey is out there with the carriers, and it's a good thing because the carriers are going to lead any kind of response in what's really a pretty grim year of 1942, at least the first 6 months until the Battle of Midway. And we're going to continue to build massive battleships. I think there's something to be said for MacArthur and Nimitz deciding to receive the Japanese surrender on this mammoth battleship, the Missouri, a good 400 feet longer almost 400 feet longer than the Arizona. But, you know, one could also say it was the American production of aircraft carriers, particularly in the expanse of the Pacific, that really won World War II in the Pacific.
And one subject for your next book, by the way, if I can recommend it now, you ought to do the court-martial of Billy Mitchell.
Oh, yeah. No, I haven't. I have the only slight hint that I've done on Billy Mitchell. I did a book, MacArthur at War, about MacArthur in the Pacific. And one of MacArthur's early politically sensitive assignments was, in fact, to serve on Billy Mitchell's court martial. But, you know, I mean, that kind of goes full circle to what we just said. I mean, Mitchell was ahead of his time. You know, yes, perhaps he wasn't most diplomatic in it. But when he sinks the captured battleships and really proves air power, this is early in the 1920s, and fast forward 20 years, it really takes this horrific tragedy, both at a national level, but as we've been talking about, so much at a personal level of these families and their sons and brothers. It takes such a toll on that.
I know obviously, the United States and so many families were grieving after Pearl Harbor. And it wasn't until Doolittle's raid on Japan that we finally felt that we were paying back the debt. Tell me if it was true. I read somewhere that when the Japanese ambassadors were in Washington at the same time, I think, as Pearl Harbor, that they had given us letters of friendship. And tell me if it's true, or if you heard that those same letters of friendship were pasted to the noses of the bombs that were dropped during Doolittle's raid.
Oh, you know, I have heard that story. I must admit, I'm not 100% sure if that's true or not, but I have heard that. And you're absolutely right that in April of 42, when they launched the Doolittle raid, I mean, that was really a pretty good boost for American morale. And in many respects, even though it didn't cause much damage in Japan, I think it suddenly made everyone from the emperor on down say, well, wait, how we were supposed to be impenetrable. How vulnerable are we? And, you know, someone you should get on your show to talk about most recent books. Of course, there's a book called The Bomber Mafia by Malcolm Gladwell, who's talking about the B-29 raids and everything. And I think that Japan just had no inkling, the people in charge, what they had, as Admiral Yamamoto really said, that they had awakened to sleeping tiger. And by the time American industry rolls out massive numbers of B-29s that conduct these horrific bombing raids over Japan, as much as they celebrated this expanse of carrier power to attack Pearl Harbor, you know, they received it back 100 or 1,000-fold in terms of their own devastation.
I had read somewhere, and very recently, that the damage done by Doolittle's, that a lot of people say that it didn't do that much in terms of taking lives, but I have read that that was suppressed by the Japanese.
Probably the far bigger loss and injury was to Japanese psyche, and even what it did and how it affected movements of ships and everything. So
Yeah, they changed their whole defensive position once they realized we could reach them.
Let's just talk if we might about a couple of the families. I think it's important to put a little bit of personal face on this. And you know, you and I have talked again as so often in the big picture about what did America expect? What did Japan expect? You know, sort of at a governmental level. But I got to tell you that I've told that story many times that I just did. But you know, at the personal level, I was surprised that in the rank and file and sailors above and below decks, there was really a premonition that war was going to begin very, very soon, and it was going to be very personal to them. Now, again, many of them are anticipating that the fleet is going to sail and that they're going to go westward, But so many of them in their letters home wrote about that. Let me just read you a paragraph from one, if I may, from Edward Budd Height. And he's writing to his girlfriend, who is the girl next door. They were sort of engaged. Nobody said that official. But he writes to Donna and he says, "When I get my next leave and we're back together, let's not waste a minute of it, because it may be the last time we get together." "Maybe he shouldn't have said that," Bud continued, "but you know as well as I," he told Donna, "that we may be at war any day now. It will be hard for those we love and those that love us. All my love, Bud." So this he's writing within a couple of weeks of December 7th. And of course, the story is that Bud was killed. His younger brother was killed as well. And I tracked down the daughter of Donna, who was quite candid in saying her mother was never the same. Yeah, she married the daughter's father, of course, and had a family, but she was just never the same. I mean, this was the great love of her life. And, you know, John, I mean, there are other stories we can talk about, too. And let me just tell you one more about the Shive brothers from California, Malcolm and Gordon. And, you know, they had grown up in Laguna Beach, kind of a rough situation. Father died young, abusive stepfather. You know, what do? You run away in 1940 and you join the service. So Gordon joins the Marines. And he's the big tough one of the two brothers, and Malcolm's a little bit more reserved. I can't really call him bookish, because I think the best grade that he got in school was an auto shop, and that was a D. Okay, so I mean these kids had it rough. Malcolm joins the Navy, so they end up. All of these battleships have capital ships have Marine detachments as guards and special duty. So Gordon's in the Marines on the Arizona, Malcolm's on the Arizona as well as a radio operator. So Gordon has been dating a girl back home by the name of Marge that they've all palled around with together growing up. So here's a little snippet from Gordon's letter to Marge, again, literally 10 days or less before December 7th. So Marge has not written Gordon in a while, and Gordon's nervous. So Gordon writes, "What's the matter? Am I poison?" Gordon had asked Marge at the start of a letter written on November 2nd, 1941. Then he got to the heart of the matter. "I have heard that you and Harry had ideas of getting hitched. Well, if you do, I hope you will be happy." Those magnanimous words aside, Gordon crossed out a couple of words and then added, "No, that isn't cursing, just a misprint." Well, clearly he was upset. So Marge's response, which has been lost, of course, because it would have been in Gordon's locker on the Arizona, set Gordon straight. He writes back to Marge again. This is now really is a couple of days. I guess it's dated November 20th of 41. "Doggone, was I glad to hear from you," Gordon wrote back. "I thought we were on the outs, but I see that I was badly mistaken." Calling himself a dope for doubting and promising not to get any, quote, more of those silly ideas, Gordon confessed this was the second letter that he had written to her. He couldn't bring it to himself to mail it. He wanted to deliver it in person. So clearly, I think at that point, we can assume that Gordon was going to ask Marge to marry him. And of course, that letter that was never hand-delivered went down as well on the Arizona. And, you know, both Malcolm and Gordon are killed. What little we have from them comes from those letters that went to both Marge and their mother, the Shives' mother. I think I was in touch with what would be their great nephew. And, you know, I got to tell you, 6 months later, Marge marries Harry, just like Gordon was worried about. So, I mean, at some level, life goes on, but there's a lot of personal trauma that's in this particular story below decks. Never mind the bigger picture things that we can talk about as far as strategy.
There was a story you wrote, I think, about an engagement ring that was never delivered to, that went down with the Arizona.
Yeah, as far as I know, that would have been Bud Height, the first letter I read there, that he had everyone suspected that he had a ring for Donna, and he was going to deliver that on his next leave. And it's to the best of my knowledge that ring was never found.
There were really just two main attacks, but all through the cleanup and all through the rescue of the few men who were still alive in the water, they were thinking that another attack was coming. That didn't just last for a day or two, did it? That lasted for a long time.
Well, it definitely lasted for a long time. I think it was probably most critical and poignant that afternoon, that Sunday afternoon, when, you know, here everybody is. You've mentioned the casualty totals. By coincidence, there was a man who lived in my town who at that point was a young medic at the hospital. And he left some reminiscences of what it was like to see this steady flow of wounded, badly burned sailors making their way into the hospital there on Hospital Point. And those who are out in the smaller ships, those are trying to get reorganized, are looking over their shoulder, absolutely looking over their shoulder. And, you know, there are reports that evening and even later, the media in Honolulu goes wild with reports that the Japanese have actually landed in northern Oahu, that a few additional explosions are related to a third wave. That doesn't happen. And of course, Admiral Nagumo on the Japanese side is severely criticized later for not launching that third attack, because as Nimitz recognizes when he gets out there, look, this is really, really bad. This is catastrophic. But the carriers are okay. The submarine pens are okay. The oil storage facilities are okay. And the dry docks are okay. So there's a heck of a mess in terms of lives and ships, but at least we're going to stand and fight from Pearl Harbor, not have to retreat to the West Coast. So on a very personal basis, so many of these brothers then spend that time, Sunday evening into Monday and Tuesday, and sometimes it takes that whole week, looking, particularly those who have been on leave or in Honolulu, going out to the Arizona, looking through the hospitals, looking through what part of the ship they can access, trying to find their brothers. And of course, unfortunately, the entire story is that it's grim. No one's able to do that. The knowledgeable kind of older hands, you know, once they've seen what the forward part of the ship looks like, and you know that your younger brother's duty station was in the number two turret that is now basically pancaked, that's pretty hard. But then the next step is even harder, because you got to either call, telegram, or write home via airmail and tell your parents that the sibling is gone. So those are some pretty rough days. And, you know, I guess, John, I just leave you with kind of this image. I end one of the chapters that as the sun went down that night, and of course we think of December, but it's really quite warm in Honolulu. It's about 80 degrees. People have been battling fires and sweltering, and you know, the moon comes up, and across the harbor there's all these little white floating objects, and you have to do a little double take and say, what is that? And of course there were so many caps that had simply been lost or come off sailors or whatever. And that, as they sort of bob through the oil slick there, again, is a very poignant and emotional moment. So, you know, those kind of things were difficult to write about.
At this point in the interview with Walter Borneman, I was thinking that we should never, ever forget Pearl Harbor, and never forget that every day of our lives as Americans, there are going to be dictators and despots plotting to take us down. I asked Walter if he had one more story to share to help us remember exactly what the price of freedom is.
Well, John, let me just add maybe one story. It doesn't come from a brother, but I think it's pretty indicative of what all of these families went through. There's a young man in the Marine detachment called Russell Durio. He's from a little town in Louisiana called Sunset. And basically, he ends up being assigned to the Arizona. And on the morning of December 7th, he's finally realized that one of the people from near his hometown that he used to play basketball against in high school is also assigned to the ship. So he's made arrangements to meet up with him, and I think they're going to go into Honolulu together. Of course, what happens is the bombs hit. Both of them are killed, and the brother of Russell Durio, who always went by the initials AD, is in Boy Scouts at the time, back in Little Sunset, Louisiana. And just a couple of days before, he has mailed to his brother, Russell, a box of cookies that his mom and a couple of aunts have stayed up all night baking. And that's going to be to share with his Marine detachment buddies and sort of an early Christmas present. Well, of course, as what happens, all of those packages that have been mailed, along with so many letters, get returned, marked addressee unknown, return to sender, unable to deliver, whatever. And that box of cookies returns to Sunset, Louisiana. And at that particular point, that's about all of Russell Durio that's coming home. So younger brother AD and his dad, Russell's dad, take that box of cookies out to the backyard and bury the box of cookies. So that's the kind of heartbreaking story that occurs through all of these families with these 38 sets of brothers. But, you know, I think if there's an absolute final takeaway, John, I mean, we just have to focus, as is your theme, that all of these men are heroes. Heroes indeed at small levels, and heroes at levels of bravery that they never thought possible that morning when they woke up. So it's been my honor and my privilege to tell their stories.
Well, I'm certainly glad you do, and thank you for this book, Brothers Down. I'm sure that our listeners are going to want to enjoy this book. It's a fantastic story of Americans in a time of crisis. And again, a story of heroism, and one that I hope no one can forget soon. Thank you very much, Walter Borneman, for joining us at 1001 Heroes. It's great to have you with us. Thank you.
You're welcome, John. It's good to be with you again.